It's also interesting to the 365 Sportscast.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matthew Blittner, and back from the banished list, he managed to avoid being Wally Pipped, is my co-host, Daniel Green. And in case you didn't catch our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is the number one, and I do mean it, the number one internet radio sports talk show outside the studio. So for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports takes. But before we get into things, I'd like to again say thank you to special guest co-host Andrew Gross for filling in for Daniel and Walt last week. Dan, how does it feel to be back?
I'm very glad I wasn't Wally Pipped, because then Andrew would have had to do the show 2,130 more times in a row. That's 40 years. I think I'm the only person in the world that could put up with you for 40 years, Matt.
Whoa, low blow, and I think we need to put you back on the banished list. But that's besides the point. We would like to say congratulations to the New York Knicks for securing their first playoff berth since the 2012-13 season. Knicks fans, it's time to rejoice. Pretend it's college basketball. You're going dancing, and you're dancing all night long with the Knicks going to the first round of the playoffs. And by the way, congratulations go out to longtime Knicks broadcaster Mike Breen, who's going into the Hall of Fame today. So congrats to him.
I mean, can you think of a guy more deserving? He's such a step above so many of the announcers. I it's such a pleasure listening to him, and I'm so excited that he's being in the Hall of Fame now.
Absolutely, and he came up. He coined the term "bang" when a big shot is made. So he's gonna hopefully get his own special thing right there in the Hall. And again, congrats to Mike Breen on an honor well deserved. Dan, getting into the actual meat of the show here today, boy oh boy, it's been two straight wacky Wednesdays for the New York Rangers. They fired last Wednesday. They fired GM Jeff Gordon and team president John Davidson. And then the other day, on a Wednesday again, they fired head coach David Quinn and most of his staff, with the exception of goalie guru Benoit Allaire, who will have that job until he says, "I don't want it anymore." So, Dan, we knew that this had to be coming, that the Rangers were going to probably move on from Quinn, regardless of who was still in charge. It was obviously made more likely by the fact that Drury was in charge, even though him and Quinn are friends. At this point, the question now becomes, who can potentially replace David Quinn as the 36th head coach of the New York Rangers?
I want to say, actually, this is sort of a less wacky Wednesday. A week ago, I was upset I wasn't on the show to break that down, because that was so crazy, that was so out of left field. This is like, we've been talking about this, should Quinn go? And we've been talking about that throughout the season, and it made sense that they made the move. It really made sense. You saw that, yes, a lot of the young guys developed this season, but ultimately, the team would just come out flat sometimes, and I think that's a sign of coaching. So what I would look for in the next coach was somebody who's inspirational, somebody who is a pump-up guy, somebody who could get you and could adjust on the fly more effectively than I think Quinn did.
All right, Dan, so who do you think is motivational and can adjust on the fly and prevent those slow starts that Quinn could not?
Okay, so I have my I have my guy. It's a little bit of a controversial choice here. I think you could probably guess.
Oh,
who it
I can't
is.
Wait for this.
No, I think Tortorella is who I want. I have a soft spot in my heart for him, but
I mean, I think New York would have a field day. My fellow media members would have an absolute field day. I know Larry Brooks in the New York Post the other day wrote how him and Tortorella would have to get the rights to the footage and have their own YouTube streaming channel based upon everything. But that's besides the point of why Tortorella would be a media circus.
I mean, you know, they say three times a charm. You know, it's this time around. I think he's somebody who, look, he has all the credentials. He's somebody who has worked here before.
And he won a Stanley Cup.
That's who my pick would be. But it doesn't seem like the Rangers are going in that direction. He's not the front runner right now.
Well, look, Drury was his captain. Dolan and Glenn Sather, who, by the way, has mysteriously started popping up more and more. Don't figure that one. They liked Tortorella. But the news is that Gerard Gallant is currently the front runner. The Rangers have requested and received permission from the Golden Knights to interview Gallant for the vacancy of the head coaching position. Gallant, look, he was in Florida with the Panthers. He helped raise a young Panthers team, and we're now starting to see the fruit of his labor. He got fired. He goes to Vegas as their inaugural coach, takes them to Stanley Cup Final year one. And then not too long after, he gets replaced by Pete DeBoer. It seems like with Gallant, he's very good with a team when he first gets there, but it seems that his message maybe wears a little thin and wears out a little quickly, because his last two stops, he wasn't there for all that long, and the Rangers need to hire a coach who's not going to be here for just 2 years. They need to hire a coach who conceivably is going to be here for the next 4 years.
I mean, this is a young team. That's I think what the Rangers should be thinking about, is they're young. They've got the first pick for the last 2 years. They've got, you know, stars like Fox. They've got Condre Miller. They've got young guys. They've got Shesterkin. This should be a long-term build. This shouldn't be somebody who is going to create a toxic culture in 2 years, even though he's somebody who has a lot of respect around the NHL and is a good coach at times.
I see you using the word toxic there. Reminds me of the article I wrote for thenyextra.com, and that clearly would be in reference to Mike Babcock, the former Toronto Maple Leaf coach.
That one has to be out.
Look, Babcock brings a lot of credibility as a head coach, but with everything that came out about what happened with him in Toronto, I have to be honest, the Garden, who is about as uptight and as image-conscious as possible, although it doesn't seem like it from time to time when Dolan gets involved with things, is not going to want the PR disaster that it would be to have Mike Babcock as the new head coach of the New York Rangers. It would not work from that standpoint. It would be worse than Tortorella's potential media circus. It really would. Look, on the ice, I'm sure the Rangers would be fantastic for at least a couple of years under Babcock. But the extracurriculars, that would not be a pleasant situation. However, the person who could potentially be a very pleasant situation is, and I thought he was a dark horse, but he's clearly being talked about as someone, is Bob Hartley, who he was the coach last of the Calgary Flames, was fired about 5 years ago now. He's been in the KHL ever since. He won a Stanley Cup with the Colorado Avalanche in 2001, for those of you who remember, that was the Ray Bourque year. And Hartley has the respect of the locker room, regardless of what locker room he goes into. He brings a winning credibility. He brings that good mix of, you know, getting through to the players, but at the same time not being, you know, making them look over their shoulder. I could see him being a very solid option, even if he's maybe not the top two choices right now.
It's not flashy. That's what I would say about it. It's not like, it's not the big boom that maybe you would be going for. But I think, I mean, he's won in a lot of different situations, so I think it's a reasonable choice for sure.
Another reasonable choice, this is a dark horse candidate, of course, would be Chris Knobloch, the head coach of the Hartford Wolfpack, who made a cameo this year as a substitute for Quinn when Quinn and his staff were dealing with COVID. And, you know, the Rangers did pretty well under him. And I know that a lot of that was still Quinn's game plan, but Knobloch did have the relaxed feel to them on the bench. He's worked with a lot of the young guys before as they've come up through Hartford. I think that he should. I know that they're heavy on the we want an experienced head coach. I don't see any reason why Knobloch should not be getting some serious consideration for this job.
Again, especially because he's worked with a lot of these guys. A lot of these guys, you know, they've come through Hartford. I think it's a reasonable choice. They were winning when he was behind the bench. It's something to think about. It would probably be my number two choice. I'm just such a soft spot for Tortorella. It's a bias.
In our production meeting, I'd like to call you out for a minute. In our production meeting, you weren't so fuzzy for Tortorella. Instead, you were very, very fuzzy for a certain coach with the initials MS.
Okay, I want to get into this. I'm not saying that this is a good idea. I'm saying it's a fun idea.
Just admit it. Say the name. Say the name.
Okay. I think we all want to think about, at least, Mark Messier as the coach for the Rangers.
There we go.
Okay. He has the personality of a coach. He's somebody who has enormous respect, both as a player and here. He has no coaching experience.
Zero. Zilch. Not even at the midget or peewee level.
But again, he loves the Rangers. He's been championing for the job, campaigning for it. They have to consider it, right? Like, it's such a...
Look, there's a rumor that if Alain Vigneault hadn't gotten the job back when he did after the insurrection against Tortorella, that Messier would have been the head coach and Brian Leetch would have been one of his assistants. So, it's not far-fetched. You know Dolan loves him. You know Sather loves him. I don't know that Drury would potentially love him so much. And, look... I know there's the whole thing, you know, great players don't necessarily make the best coaches. So, defend yourself. Why would a great player like Messier all of a sudden become an excellent coach when he has no experience?
Okay, I'm not saying he would be an excellent coach. I think it is a really important option for the Rangers to consider. Because what he has and what we always saw as a player was a tremendous amount of grit. He was somebody who...
He's not going to be on the ice, though.
No, but that attitude is going to carry through. That way that he carries himself, that he was as a player, the way that...
Clearly, that doesn't always work. Quinn was the same type of thing, and he did not... And it clearly did
Messier.
Not carry over.
I mean, but it's Messier. It's a different level of that. And I think it would be interesting from that perspective. It's really interesting how much he wants the job. I think that is also desirable. Now, I don't know that he should be the coach. I don't know how he'd be... With the media, I don't know how he'd be with all the...
He'd be good until he got criticized.
I don't know how he'd be with the bad times. I don't know how he'd be with no coaching experience. I'm just saying
He should give a call to his friend Wayne Gretzky and ask him how that went in Arizona.
It's flashy and it's fun. And that's what I like about it. And I think Dolan definitely likes flashy and fun. That seems like his motto.
Glenn Sather seems to like it too. He's been popping up a lot more, and goodness knows why that's the case.
So if that's the case, it's an intriguing option. I don't think it's going to happen, though.
No, I don't think it will, and that's probably for the best. And Messier's close friend Brian Leetch actually resigned from the Rangers last night in a surprising move. He had been working in the hockey operations department. You have to wonder why Leetch all of a sudden just up and resigned. Did he not like the fact that Davidson and Gordon were fired? Did he not like the fact that Quinn was fired? Did he not like the fact that Drury was elevated to the dual positions of president and GM? Did he just not like the job anymore? Is there something to do with his wife, with the legal battles that she's had the last few years? I don't know, but this is something that really could potentially play a factor into all this.
And it goes into what I would really want to know, which I think is maybe the overarching theme of this, is this a desirable place to be? With Dolan getting more involved potentially, with what happened last week, with the suddenly upheaval, you've got a lot of young talent on the team, but all of a sudden you wonder, is this a place that a coach would want to come?
Oh, coaches definitely want to come here. They've got a lot of young talent on the rise.
But I'm saying... With something like Leetch, is he leaving also partly because of the organization and because he doesn't like the way that the organization is maybe handling things?
Or maybe he found out potentially that Messier is not under consideration and he doesn't want, and you know, he viewed himself as potentially being Messier's assistant coach, so maybe that's part of it. Who knows? This is all speculation. I have not spoken to Leetch. I've not spoken to Messier. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but it is something that could very much be an intriguing situation that someone of his caliber who had the position that he did just up and left. it raises more questions than it gives answers to. And we're going to leave you with that thought about the New York Rangers. We're going to be joined in a minute by New York Yankee historian Marty Appel, who is going to talk to us about an update with his Pinstripe Empire book and talk to us about what's going on with the New York Yankees. So I'm going to get him while we reinstate Daniel's vamping to all of you, something that we didn't have last week, and I'll be right back.
I missed my little my monologues to the audience and my one-way conversation that I would have with them. I'm so excited to talk with Marty Appel. He's one of the people who I think does a tremendous job. He is the preeminent Yankees historian. The Pinstripes Empire, which we're going to talk with him a little bit on the updates he made, is the greatest history of the Yankees. It's very comprehensive. He's somebody who's been around the team since the 70s, and he's seen it all. He's seen it all, and I really am curious to gauge what is his current feelings about how this team compares with some of the teams from the past. How do individual players go? How, even though the game has changed, and we've all talked about the game has changed because of a combination of sabermetrics and it's a different kind of era, what are those parallels that he sees, and how can we use the past to kind of gauge the future? Because they always say history, those who don't learn their history are doomed to repeat it. From a baseball sense, it's that those who don't have a knowledge of their history or do have a knowledge of their history, maybe they have more insight into what's currently going on with the team right now. So Matt is going to come bring him in here, and we're going to get into a lot of that stuff. The Yankees have been, they've been pretty hot lately. I mean, you all heard it. You heard my co-host, Mr. Blitner, who is a pessimistic Yankee fan because they haven't won in the last 10 years, really kind of jumping off a cliff. I had a fan of the show call me and basically said, your co-host is being wild and wildly saying that the Yankee season is over despite the fact that it's April. And the Yankees have really shown that to be true. They've really turned it around, which is not surprising. The rotation has pitched better. You know, they can score with anybody. Stanton is obviously a great player. So I'm excited to talk about all of this historically and now with...
We're having a little trouble getting in touch with our guest, Marty Appel, at the moment, ladies and gentlemen. So that's why Daniel is vamping a little bit longer than he normally would be. We do apologize for that as we are trying to get in touch with Mr. Appel. In the meantime, while we wait for him to log in with us, we're going to currently try to talk about the NFL schedule drop that happened on Wednesday. And, you know, it was a big story when it dropped. Of course, a lot of people on social media treat it like a national holiday. And, I mean, it's not a national holiday, but a lot of people think it should be. And so there are a few games that we want to talk about. The Packers are going to be on national television 5 times.
I mean, who's
five,
more
five
who's
times more in 17 games?
Who's more intriguing than the Packers right now?
They're going to be on 5 times in 17 games on national television, and they might not have Aaron Rodgers as their quarterback. So either the networks know something that we don't, or they are taking the biggest gamble imaginable with this, because no one is going to want to see Blake Bortles or Jordan Love 5 times a year on national TV.
I might for comedic reasons, but that joke gets old. I only want to see that once. I mean, I think that was a very... I think that he will be back, and I think that that's what they're gambling on, and who doesn't want to see Aaron Rodgers play 5 times? But for our New York teams, by the way, I just want to say this about the Giants. We've talked about how it's year 3 of Daniel Jones coming up, and he's got a lot to prove. And this schedule reiterates that. This is not a difficult schedule. They're starting out with a relatively light schedule to begin the season. They start with the Broncos, then they go to Washington, and then Atlanta. I mean, they do have some hard games. They're playing the Chiefs, they're playing the Bucks, but again, this is a prove-it year, and this is a schedule where it's like, it's on the table. The Giants should be able to win this division if and should be able to make a run at the playoffs with the talent they have if Daniel Jones develops and the rest of the team develops around him.
And look, the Giants, of course, they're going to have an interesting thing. They definitely went out and got some weapons for Jones. They have done what they can with the limited resources that they have available to make something happen. But I have to say, I'm a lot more intrigued by what's going to happen with the Jets' schedule. They're facing Sam Darnold in week one. That's just plain torture right there. That's someone in the NFL office in the scheduling department deciding to have a good laugh at the expense of Jet fans, because I don't care how good Zach Wilson is or becomes, he could become the second coming of Peyton Manning for all I care. The fact that they have to face Sam Darnold in week one of their new regime, I'm telling you right now, Darnold is throwing for 450 yards and 4 touchdowns. You can take that to the bank in Las Vegas today.
I'll tell you what. I only wish that the game had been in December, because revenge is a dish best served cold. This is going to be...
Oh, you were waiting way too long to use that.
This is going to be a great start to the season. I can't wait for it. I love that from the NFL. I love them saying, all right, Darnold, prove it. Go back to your former team. Let's start off with it.
And he's not Christian McCaffrey as his running back.
Now, that Carolina team is a weird team, because I like the coach. I like Rhule. But, you know, I mean, we've talked about it's all about if Sam Darnold can really make that progression. And, boy, we're going to find out quickly. Because the thing about Darnold, one of the knocks on him was, how did he respond to the pressure? There was obviously that game where he famously said he saw ghosts. This is pressure. It's coming right away for him. So it's kind of like,
this isn't pressure. This is a well. This is a medium well state that he's going to turn the New York Jets secondary into. That's what he's going to do. Forget pressure for a minute. He's going to take them and he's going to spin them up and he's going to chew them out. He's going to chew them up and spit them out. That's what he's going to do.
Now, I will say, this is, and also, this is not a great secondary. This is the opposite. This is a team that did not address its secondary in the draft because they're rebuilding and they went more on the offensive side of the ball. But the thing also is, Matt, we're also a little bit biased because Sam Darnold is such a... He's a good guy. You can hear that when he does interviews. You hear what a genuine person he is. And even though you're a Jets fan, I think there's a part of you that's a little bit like, he deserves this.
He deserves it, and he's going to have us having a nightmare week one, which is just going to be dandy, because who do the Jets get in week two? They get, wait for it, they get the New England Patriots. Someone in the NFL scheduling department is having a good laugh right now at Jets fans, and I want his name. If you know it, I want his name, and I want it now.
But, okay, yes, that is true. The Jets, they're starting out with New England, they're starting out with Carolina. But again, the Jets also have kind of a light schedule. They have Jacksonville. They have Houston. I don't know what's happening in Houston. That could be anything. Anybody could be playing there. They're a mess. Jacksonville, I mean, we saw with the whole Tebow thing this week, they're potentially a mess.
That's not until the end of the season. I thought you said they were starting off.
I didn't say starting off. I said they have a light schedule relatively overall. They have the Bengals. The Bengals are, I mean, maybe Burrow's going to take huge step forwards in year two, but they're not a great team. So they have the Eagles, who, again, the Eagles are also kind of an organization in a lot of flummox. So the Jets have some winnable games. Now, they might not be good enough to take advantage of that. That might be their biggest issue.
The exciting part is going to be them going all the way across the pond to London to face the Atlanta Falcons. Now, I'm assuming Matt Ryan's going to be healthy and playing in that game. I'm assuming Julio Jones is going to be healthy and playing in that game. I'm assuming Calvin Ridley is going to be healthy and playing in that game. I'm going to stop right there.
Kyle Pitts.
Forget him for a second. I'm going to stop and right there with those weapons. Ladies and gentlemen, I wake up. I watch the Jets. I go to sleep, I watch the Jets, depending on if it's a late game on a Thursday night, or, you know, they're rarely on the Sunday night game, or if they're on Monday night. That is a game I will not be waking up for 9:30 in the morning, our time, to watch the Jets get utterly destroyed in New England, in London, England, against the Falcons. That will be 28-0 by the end of the first quarter.
By the way, the whole NFL going to London thing, I obviously see why they're doing it, and it's fun. But then again, Does anybody really want to get up for those games, by the way? Like,
I mean, if it's a good matchup, you get up for it.
It's never
but
a good matchup.
That's not the
it's
matchup.
Never, it's never a good matchup. It's always teams that they're like, well, we have to make somebody do it. So I guess the Jets, who were the second worst team, and the Falcons, who were the fourth worst team. By the way, do British people now think that American football is like not as good because they've seen a lot of bad teams? Like, are they going to think the Jets is what good American football is like?
That's a good question and one I don't have an answer for you. So that's going to be something that we're going to have to wait and see about. In the meantime, we're going to quickly get a word from our sponsor, Joto, and when we come out of the quick commercial break, we're hoping to have Mr. Appel back. If we do not, we will move into our own discussion about the other baseball team in New York, and that is the Red Hot New York Mets.
I'm so glad that we get to talk about Joco. Joco is the most convenient, sustainable, and enjoyable way to commute around New York City. It's an electric assist bike share program. It's got 100 private locations in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens. Micromobility has grown significantly over the past year, and it's easy to see why. Most trips in New York, they're faster, they're more convenient on a bike than on the subway. These bikes are electrically assisted, so it's a lot less effort, it's easier on some of the hills, and it's faster than a traditional bike. Joco bikes, they're sleek, they're orange, they're beautiful. They provide a slight workout or a rigorous workout if you want. They're easy to use. All you have to do is download the app in the App Store and find participating Joco bike locations. And for a limited time only, use promo code OTS15 for a 15-minute ride or promo code MEM15 for a discount on your membership. Check out the website at RideJoco.com and the Instagram RideJoco to get more. So go out and ride a Joco bike today. And just to repeat that, the promo code is OTS15 for a 15-minute ride and OTS MEM for a discount on your membership. It helps the show. It helps you get a nice ride and really a pleasurable way to commute around New York City.
Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, please go out, use those promo codes, use a Joco bike, make it part of your daily commute. It's something that, you know, we're really excited about our partnership with them, and we're really excited about the potential and future that they have as a company here in New York. So that's going to be very interesting. What is also very interesting is the Red Hot New York Mets, who are on a 7-game win streak. We hope not to jinx them. We didn't jinx the Knicks when we talked about their win streak, so we're hoping to make it 2-for-2. The Mets, they have some key injuries. That's right off the bat. Brandon Nimmo, Jacob DeGrom. And DeGrom's the big one. They're out right now. And yet, they're still winning, which is a good thing for the Mets. But how are they winning? Dan, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. Patrick Mazita had 2 walk-offs and 3 RBIs. And he does not have a single hit in his Major League career. He's the first person to do this. And he's not the first person to do this year, or in Mets history, or in the last decade, or in the last 50 years. He's the first person to do this ever. He has 2 walk-offs, ladies and gentlemen. He does not have a career hit. He has 2 walk-off fielder's choices. Gary Cohen said it best on the broadcast. He is the king of the walk-off fielder's choice. In my lifetime, all almost 28 years, I don't think I've ever once heard someone called a king of a fielder's choice.
Well, what this points to, it's very exciting. And Matt, you're a very big fan of obscure statistics, so I know you had a field day with this. And
I'm waiting for Jason Stoss to drop the article on The Athletic to find out about this, believe me.
But here's the other thing that this points to, is that when you're winning, when you're hot, those statistical anomalies, they go your way. And that's what you're seeing with the Mets. The Mets are pitching really well, putting themselves in a good position to win so that, and then once that happens, like the ball just bounces your way. Like when you're on a win streak, there's just a phenomenon in the air. We're going to talk with somebody who talks about the baseball gods, who's written a book about the baseball gods next week.
He's written a whole series about the baseball gods.
We're dropping a little bit of a cliffhanger. You'll hear that next week. But one of the things is there really is this idea of the baseball gods. When your team is hot, there's just something unexplainable. There's just something where the ball bounces your way. The fielder's choice goes your way. You get that RBI. And really, the Mets winning, it's got to start with his pitching. I mean, you see a lot of these scores. They're not giving up a lot of runs. It starts with, you know, Stroman. Starts with a future friend of the show, Tejon Walker. I like to call him a future friend, you know.
Do you know something I don't know?
I mean, he retweeted. Remember that one time he replied to me on Twitter? That was a big moment for me.
Okay, Phil Hughes replies to me consistently on Twitter. He hasn't been on the show.
We don't need to get into a social media flexing battle. But what I'm more impressed about with him is how well he's pitched in a lot of these games. And here's the thing about the Mets. They're winning in a lot of different ways. The bullpen has been weirdly good. And even in games when they're used an opener, they've pitched well. They've been able to have the depth to make up with that. Now, remember, when we started this show, when we were started talking about the Mets this offseason, that was the concern. Do they have the depth? It seems like they might.
Look, they very well might. The mark of a good team is the depth all around, and they're getting those contributions up and down the lineup. The bullpen, you know, we've touched it. Aaron Loop came in as a free agent. He's done well. Trevor May's come in as a free agent. He's done well. Familia's back. Maybe he's, you know, finally figured something out in his career. I'm not even going to go there with that. He's doing well. Edwin Diaz has pitched better of late. Not quite. Take that as you will. And I know the Mets, they beat the Orioles. They beat the Diamondbacks. In the grand scheme of things, they should be beating teams like the Orioles and the Diamondbacks. That's the way baseball works. The good teams beat the bad teams. The middling teams beat the bad teams. And the bad teams beat up on each other. That's how this works. And what distinguishes who is good and who is not is the fact that the good teams can also beat the good teams. The Mets have proven now they can beat the bad teams. Can they distinguish between being a middling team, where, you know, they're about 500 versus the good teams, or are they capable of winning against the good teams too? And that's a question that needs to be answered.
Now, they did start this off by beating the Cardinals, who are a good team, and I think ultimately will win that NL Central division. But all you can do is beat the teams on the schedule. All you can do is do what you can for the guy in front of you. So the other day, when Matt Harvey came back, and I know that was the big moment for a lot of Mets fans and him. He actually spoke about how he got a lot of closure out of that. He's not the pitcher he once was. This isn't Matt Harvey from 2015.
It's not Harvey Day anymore.
It's not Harvey Day anymore. But again, that's all you could do is get hits against that guy who's in front of you.
The Mets fans, I have to give it to them. They were very classy in how they handled Harvey's return. They gave him a cheer. They gave him an ovation. They didn't boo him. They didn't even boo when he got knocked off the mound after giving up 8 runs to the Mets. Well, they cheered him in that situation, too.
Well, it's easy to not boo a guy who you just beat up on. But the point is well taken. It was a classy way, and it was a good return for him.
Look, we hope that Harvey can somewhat find something in his career again. It would, of course, be an absolute, you know, great thing to see if he can recapture even some of his Dark Knight persona while in Baltimore. Just hopefully not against the Yankees. Let him do it if they face off against the Mets or the Marlins or anyone else in the major leagues. So that's all good and well. We're going to right now, it does not look like Marty Appel is answering us at the moment. Maybe something came up. I'll try to get more information on that as the show develops. So we're going to right now talk about something that's coming up in 2 days from now, and that is the New York Islanders beginning the hunt for Stanley Cup championship number 5. They are back in the playoffs, ladies and gentlemen, and what a way to send the Coliseum off again, hopefully in style, as the Islanders will face the Pittsburgh Penguins in round 1 of the Stanley Cup playoffs this year. And these two teams have a lot of history. Forget the regular season. They have a lot of playoff history. There was 1975 when the Islanders in the second round faced the Penguins, went down 3-0 in the series, came back, forced Game 7 in Pittsburgh, won Game 7 1-0 on Captain Ed Westfall's goal. And by the way, Ed Westfall told me he was so late in getting changed after the game, getting showered and changed, that his teammates had all left. They had all gone to celebrate. So he was left to have to go to dinner and drinks with the Penguins players that they just eliminated. Talked about that as irony, by the way. Dan, if that was you, you would have been yelling and screaming, cursing up a storm. Where the heck are your teammates and everything? Texting everybody, sending phone messages, sending telegrams, you name it.
Smoke signals?
This was 1975, you know. You have to go back to the limit of technology that they had back then. He ended up having to go celebrate with the Penguins players. What Penguins player in their right mind wants to celebrate with a guy who just eliminated them, and not only eliminated them, but eliminated them after they blew a 3-0 series lead? So, there's that. There was the early 80s during the Dynasty with the Islanders on the ropes in the series against the Penguins, and they ended up being able to come back and win that. There was 1992-93, the David Vollant goal, after Pierre Turgeon had been knocked out of the series. That was a massive, massive upset that knocked off a Penguins dynasty in the making. You had 2011 Fight Night, which, of course, was a regular season game, but, you know, goes without saying that that's part of their history. 2013, they had a heated series. 2018-19, the Islanders swept the Penguins in their return to the Coliseum in the playoffs. I mean, what more needs to go on between these two teams, Dan?
No, it sets a beautiful backstage. It sets a beautiful stage for this story. And there's another side of this. Let's bring it to the present day for a second. We've got a Penguins team that's hot. We've got an Islanders team that's not so hot. The Islanders were looking like they could be that top slot, and the Penguins were looking like they would not be. The fortunes have flipped, and now...
What's with the dramatic tone in your voice all of a sudden?
I'm excited about it, Matt. I'm excited about this series. This is kind of the one I was hoping for. Like, as a fan, I think this was the one that I was hoping to see. I think these teams are intriguing against each other. They do have all of that history. And also, you know, who doesn't love watching, you know, the Penguins, the old guys at this point? Crosby, Malkin, who's back. And watching what they're capable of. And watching... Do you, like, what way does this series go? That's really the question, is what direction does it go?
I mean, let's not forget the third member of that triumvirate in Tris Letang, who, again, was one of the top point scoring defensemen in the National Hockey League this year. So, Dan, I want to break this down. With, you know, offense, defense, goaltending, special teams, coaching, okay? So let's get it out of the way. We know the Islanders' offense does not match up with Pittsburgh.
No.
If Anders Lee was in there, they still would not match up with Pittsburgh, but at least they'd be more well-balanced. But, you know, without Anders Lee in there, and with Kyle Palmieri being cold, and with Matt Barzal being streaky, although he's on the upswing at the moment, and Anthony Beauvillier being the same way, and Brock Nelson being the same way, and Travis Zajac not exactly fitting into the lineup the way they thought he would, and J.G. Pageau being streaky, and Oliver Wahlstrom still being a rookie, and Jordan Eberle being streaky. I mean, if this team can get hot, the offense can absolutely do itself a favor and really take over this series. Unfortunately, we just spent the last 6 weeks seeing that the offense doesn't seem to want to do that.
But again, this is, as our co-host, Walt Bonet, has eloquently said in the past, this is a team that is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. That's just the nature of how they play. And... look, Palmieri, they made a big splashy move for him at the deadline that we broke down and said, this could be the key. This could be what pushes them past. It's time for him to prove himself. It's time for him
to... I mean, he has the pedigree. He can absolutely do it. It's a matter of whether or not he will do it.
Yeah.
And it's not a choice. I'm not saying that he, you know, was choosing not to play well. Obviously, he wants to play well. But for whatever reason, it hasn't worked so far on the Islands for Palmieri.
No, and that's going to be, I think, the key to this series, and we'll get more to that as we break this down, but it's definitely going to be the key to this offense, is can he pick it up and really provide some of what they lost when they lost Anders Lee? And also, you've got to score against the Penguins. I mean, they're going to score. I'm not worried about them.
Yeah, look, any offense led by Sid the Kid Crosby, who's actually not a kid
he's
anymore.
He's now Sid the Man? Like, what is he? Sid the Mid?
Of Denny Malkin and Chris Letang on defense, not to mention Jake Guentzel. That I have to give the Penguins the full advantage, the whole enchilada on the offensive side. The defense, I think, is a bit more of an intriguing situation. You've got Letang, who can, you know, of course, provide offense for Pittsburgh on the blue line. But beyond that, I don't really know that they've got anyone. I know the Islanders are stretched thin on defense. They only have the 6 guys. But you have Ryan Pollock, who, very good defense. Is that a howitzer of a shot? I just wish that shot found the back of the net more often than it did this year. You have Adam Pellett, who is, you know, he's steady. He is a very steady D partner for Pollock. Then you get to a bit of the problem. Nick Leddy has been fantastic in the assist department this year, and he's still got speed, which is saying something for the fact that he's in his 30s now. You have Scott Mayfield, who's an excellent penalty killer. But something about the two of them together just does not seem to click. And we don't know why, but they just do not seem to click together. And that's a bit of a problem because they play top 4 minutes. And if they can't be trusted to go up against the Penguins' second unit, then that's going to be a major issue because Noah Dobson and Andy Green, Dobson's still young and Green is, look, he's reliable, he's steady, but he's not going to be someone that you can count on for 20, 25 minutes a night anymore. So they need to play sheltered minutes, that third defensive pair. Pollock and Pellett can only play so much of the game. So you're going to need Mayfield and Leddy to be that tandem that can respond and can really do their job. And I don't know that they can do it this year, which is a problem.
And you worry about the lack of depth, especially in a playoff series, especially in one like this, where
if someone gets injured, that's it. They're better off playing with 5
in a 7-game series. And we all know what playoff hockey does to a team. And
especially first-round playoff hockey. COVID be damned. They are going to be at each other's throats, these players.
It's a different game. And you really wonder, with that lack of depth, Do they have a chance? Do they have a chance to really stick with it? Especially if these games start to go into overtime, what's going to happen there?
I see Pollock playing somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 minutes in an overtime game. Believe me, Barry Trotz won't want to do it. It's going to be necessary. I give the edge, slight edge, not a big edge, slight edge, width of a skate edge to the Islanders on defense for the totality of their unit.
Well, the talent is more, but the depth is the question.
The one thing that's not in question is the goalie situation. Well, at least for the Islanders, it's not a question. Pittsburgh, they don't know who's going to be in net. Probably Tristan Jarry, but you never know. The Islanders have a legitimate number one, a legitimate Vezina candidate in Semyon Varlamov, who, yeah, he's banged up a little bit. He hasn't been staying the last few days. But even if Varlamov can't go, you have Ilya Sorokin, who has proven he can handle himself. Now, look, playoffs are a different animal. Very different animal. It's Earth to Jupiter, a different animal. But the Islanders are confident with whoever they have in net, and whether it be Varlamov or Sorokin, and it will be Varlamov. He will be out there come Sunday. There's no question in my mind that he will be out there. That is a clear advantage for the Islanders over whoever Pittsburgh throws in net. This is the one area, look, a good goalie can steal you a game. A great goalie can steal you a series. And Semyon Varlamov could steal you a whole lot of series.
This is actually some wisdom that I got from my own father, who, of course, has been on the show. He always said to me, look, the regular season is what it is in hockey. But once you get to the playoffs, if you have a goalie who can get hot, who's capable, that can make the difference in a series, especially when the games are close. And we've seen it. Look, we've seen it with, we saw it with the Rangers back when they had Lundqvist. We've seen the goalie.
By the way, happy Henrik Lundqvist, belated happy Henrik Lundqvist Day to everybody yesterday, as that was the anniversary of his three of his game seven victories in which he did not allow a goal. Just think about that.
And again, that goalie edge is such a big thing when it comes to the playoffs. It really can make a difference that And the Islanders have a clear edge. It's not just like a... They really have
an edge.
It's
not an edge. It's an advantage.
It's a real advantage.
Now, where they are clearly at a very bad disadvantage is one half of the special teams. And that one half would be their penalty, their power play. The Islanders' power play was 26 for 143 this year, I believe it was, in the regular season. I'm not a mathematician. Thank goodness for that. That's not a very good percentage, ladies and gentlemen. That is a power play that needs help. And look, Pittsburgh does not have an all-world penalty kill, but if you're not going to put pucks on the net, and if you're not going to score on the power play, you're going to be hard-pressed to find victories in a seven-game series. And that is going to be a problem.
No, it's absolutely going to be a problem. And that's the kind of thing. Again, it's small edges that make a big difference in the playoffs. And
that's a gaping hole.
And that's a gaping hole. And I want to talk about another edge that I think will ultimately... I mean, we're going to get into what we're thinking about for this series, but I'm going to get into another edge which I think could also make a big difference, which is the combination of the Penguins are at home. So if the series is close, it's a game seven. And that experience.
And the Islanders have not been good on the road this year.
And again, you can't teach experience. You can't teach somebody to be Sidney Crosby or Malkin. You can't.
They don't need to be that level of talent, but the playoff experience is key.
Nobody has a pedigree like that. And
I mean, the Islanders have been in the playoffs the last 2 years. With basically the same group. They've gone far. They went to the second round 2 years ago, and they went to the conference final last year. So they're playoff
something.
Tested.
They are tested. They have something, but it's nothing like what these guys have. Nothing like it.
Well, that's an intangible. What's not intangible is how amazing the Islanders' penalty kill has been. They killed off something like 111 of 135 penalties this year. That is outstanding work by them. That's the complete opposite of their power play, ladies and gentlemen. I know Pittsburgh has a lethal power play, but that is not something that is going to be a situation. The penalty kill is going to be a huge advantage for the Islanders.
No, absolutely. And when you think about a series like this, you think about like key in late games, and especially key in late in the game when there's a big penalty that happens, who can overcome that? Who is able to really, you know, make up for some of those issues, make up for some of those difficulties that can happen? And nobody is better than the Islanders have been this year. And, you know, it's just, I'm so excited for this series, because the thing is, what you're really getting, wait, actually, it sounds like our guest Marty Appel has actually, we've been able to get him back online, so that's great news, and can't wait to talk with him today, talk a lot about Yankees history, so we're really glad to have him back.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back with our advertised guest, Marty Appel. Marty, it's Matt and Dan at Outside the Studio. Thank you for getting on the show here with us today.
Well, thank you for understanding. I apologize for not being on earlier, but here I am from Central Park.
No worries. And, you know, it's a nice day to be in Central Park. And, you know, I'm going to ask this to you now. You know, you mentioned to me that you have an update on this very intriguing Pinstripe Empire book. And, you know, Yankee fans, I'm sure you'll probably be recognized in Central Park, you know, how long you've been around the team and everything. But what do we need to know about this update?
Well, the book first came out in 2012, and I was delighted by the reception it received. And I think over the last 9 years, people have come to see it as like the definitive history of the franchise going all the way back to 1903. So it does go back to the very beginnings. It was updated once in paperback up through the 2015 season, but now I've updated it again through 2020. And actually the COVID season had a lot of interesting things to write about. So it's not yet posted. It's the ebook version that will be updated. So for some people, it will be their first exposure to seeing the whole book. But anyway, in a matter of a couple of weeks, Bloomsbury, the publisher, will post it, and I'll put it all over social media, too, that it's now been updated, and I'm glad it stays relevant.
And it makes a lot of sense that the update is coming for this 2020 season. It was such a crazy time. It's such a definitive moment in Yankees history going forward. And what exactly did you feel like was really important to update in that part of the book?
Well, first of all, it deals with the retirements of Rivera and Jeter and the crazy goings on with Alex Rodriguez and his eventual retirement. Then we go to London for the Yankee Red Sox London series in 2019.
That was a heck of a series.
Which I attended, so I get to write that trip off on my taxes because it's part of the book. And 2020 will, you know, hopefully be a season like no other. And just the way the teams and the Yankees, of course, coped with all that was thrown at them and all that was going on. I mean, we never had a season before where you'd get a game called off so you'd play somebody else, but that's what was happening.
As everyone has said, it is a season like no other and hopefully one that will never happen again. Marty, Aaron Boone has been a big part of, and I can't believe I'm saying it this way, has been a big part of helping the Yankees manage through everything. You know, he's been the focal point. He's been the face of the franchise to be able to explain, you know, what's going on with all the situations, including even now the eight players, staff, and everyone, coaches who have tested positive for COVID. So, in your opinion, where does Boone rank in the best managers in Yankee history? And if he's not number one, who is number one?
Well, he's not number one because he hasn't gone to a World Series. And I think that's kind of important. The argument was always Miller Huggins, Joe McCarthy, Casey Stengel, all in the Hall of Fame and all had enormous success with the Yankees. To me, the answer is Joe Torre, because Torre had to deal with things that his predecessor managers did not, such as an eclectic roster of players who spoke foreign languages, had long-term contracts, all dealt with agents, and that was unlike anything the other three guys had had. In addition, he had a very demanding boss. The other guys didn't. He had sports talk radio and social media and everybody second-guessing every move. The other guys didn't have that. And he had to beat 13 opponents in his league and then three rounds in the playoffs. The other guys didn't have anything close to that. And while Casey Stengel winning five straight World Series will always be a marvel, Torre won 4 out of 5 years with all of these factors that I've just mentioned. So to me, he is the greatest manager in Yankee history.
That is a really interesting and compelling argument, especially because of what a manager actually has to do on a day-to-day basis. But I noticed that you notably left out Billy Martin. What would you say to people who defend his reputation and say, similarly, he had a lot that he had to go through and he had been fired all these times? What would you say to somebody who would bring him
up?
Well,
the first thing I would say is he won one World Series with the Yankees. But the other thing I would say is he may have been the best in-game manager for those 2.5 to 3 hours in the dugout. Certainly the best that I ever saw at that. He was a genius when it came to strategy and thinking ahead. He didn't need all the analytics we have now. It was in his head. So Billy rates very high. But again, the one World Series will always keep him out of the argument.
Well, it's a fair point. It's one that, you know, you are judged on how many rings or trophies that you have. So, you know, like it or not, for people who will debate it, that is a major statistic that people need to accumulate. And this current Yankees core that's been together since 2016, 2017, they've gone to the ALCS twice. They have not gotten to the World Series yet. Now, maybe they will this year. Maybe they won't. Well, that time will tell. And
maybe they should have in 2017. When
yes. Well, that you know that that was not within their control, and you know that's a whole other can of worms. In your opinion here, where does this era of Yankee teams, because you get the feeling that after this year, if they don't do it, that there will be some changes in the works, where does this era of Yankees rank with all the others?
It needs for Stanton and Judge to fulfill their promise and to be the superstars that they could be in order for us to look at it as a magnificent era. So that has to happen. Also, we have to be able to look back at the 10 years that they've invested in Gary Sanchez to see whether he can really step up and be the next great Yankee catcher in the team's long history. So there's still a lot of things that have to happen for this team to earn that respect.
Yeah, and look, it's before we let you go, and for those of you who are just joining us, we're talking with noted Yankee historian Marty Appel. Marty, what are your thoughts on this current Yankees season in general? Because this is a season that it's not the season like no other from last year, but it's pretty close.
Well, it's taught me patience, and I hope other people too. I mean, on social media, everybody was ready to fire everybody after that slow start. And then, sure enough, they began to rise to their best of their abilities. So we have to be patient with a 162-game schedule and not be ready to fire the manager and all the coaches and all the players with a bad start.
Well, thank you for your opinion on that, and hopefully the Yankees continue on what can be a very productive run. And Marty, we hope to, you know, hear back from you once the update is fully published for the Pinstripe Empire, and we wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you so much. Apologies again for being late to the party, but enjoyed speaking with you, and hope we do it again.
You're welcome, and thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's that time of the show again where we're going to move right now into our noted fan caller. His name is David, and he is coming to us from Brooklyn, New York, which is impressive. David, it's Matt and Dan with Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
Hey, guys. Thank you so much. Love the show.
Thanks you for listening, David. So what's this hot take of yours?
Absolutely. My hot take is actually just going to be echoing what I think that the people to my left and the people to my right are saying about baseball. I grew up an Indian fan before I had cable TV in the house. So I used to watch pitch by pitch on the GameCast without any type of picture. What I'm wondering is, with your professional take, each of you, what are the things that baseball can do in the short term and long term to help broaden the appeal with this kind of ADD, phone in the face, face in the phone type crowd? What can be done to bring baseball back? I see it dropping almost to a point of irrelevancy. How can we help it?
I think the start has to be marketing its stars better. There are some of the most unbelievable baseball players, and people don't even know about it. The league has a massive marketing problem. And back in those days, and even before, baseball was defined by its stars. It was defined by guys like Mays. It was defined by guys like Hank Aaron. And even later, it was defined by guys like Jeter. And that was really how the sport came to the masses. There needs to be that return and building up of the players.
It certainly doesn't help that Mike Trout, the best player in the game, plays his games on the West Coast on a team that doesn't win. And if you're on the East Coast, you have to stay up late to watch, which people don't want to do. They have work, they have jobs, they have lives. So the fact that he plays out there, it almost puts him in obscurity, which hurts the game as well. Not to say that you can't have a player play on the West Coast and be a marquee face of the game, but you have to find a way to work with that. And as of right now, Major League Baseball is failing in that regard, as you mentioned. You have to find the ways, you know, social media has done more to hurt the game. As much as it has helped the game reach with its reach, it has hurt the game because it is something that is taking away people from watching and just having them check their phones for a brief highlight. So that's an issue as well.
And another thing about baseball, one of the things that makes it unique is all of the crazy quirks about the game. And That needs to be brought to the public. So there needs to be more attention on all of the crazy things that can happen. As Matt discussed and we discussed, the fielder's choice walk-offs are such an interesting part of the game. Just that kind of random statistics. And that needs to be brought about in the right way. That needs to be discussed in the right way.
And thank you, David, for bringing up this very interesting conversation for us. And we hope that you continue to tune in to us every single week.
Of course, I won't miss. Will not miss the show.
Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's that time of the show again. We are out of time. If you missed our live show, you can catch the recording on thenyextra.com, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes, Apple, SoundCloud, and please tune back in next Friday, May 21st at 4 p.m. For more hot and cold takes, once again, I'm Matthew Blitner. To my left is the non-Wally-pipped co-host, Daniel Green, saying thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, please visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full works. And we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.